As his first year, and he's done a great job, as he has all of the 13 previous years in various capacities for the foundation, is Mr. Vincent DePaul Drotty, who will introduce the gold medal winner for 1971. Vince, congratulations.
As chairman of the National Football Foundation, it gives me great pleasure to present the foundation's most coveted award to the 33rd governor of the state of California. Governor Ronald Reagan was a campus leader during his college days in Illinois and was cut from the same cloth as these outstanding young men that you see here tonight. A three-year varsity football player at Eureka College, Governor Reagan worked his way through college, washing dishes, waiting on tables. In addition, he was president of the student body and was concerned and involved with campus life at a tough time in our nation's history, the Depression, which you young fellows don't remember. Three times, Governor Reagan has been a success in three different fields: in sportcasting the Notre Dame and Big Ten football games, in the entertainment field, and in the political arena. He served his country with distinction during World War II. Four presidents, a justice of the Supreme Court, one of America's greatest generals, are included among the men who have received the National Football Foundation's Gold Medal Award. Governor Reagan, like these outstanding men and others honored over the years, you measure up in every way. Congratulations. The gold medal, and I'll read the inscription, presented to Ronald Wilson Reagan, Governor of California, athlete and campus leader, prominent in the entertainment world, a dedicated public servant whose achievements express genuine concern for the future of our nation. Governor Reagan.
Chairman Drotty, Dr. Tate, and the new members of the Hall of Fame, and these distinguished young men who were here, my old friend, Senator George Murphy. Murph, you and I just somehow keep turning up on a late show. It is a pleasure, of course, to be here. But, of course, coming to New York always has one benefit as far as I'm concerned. It's one place that's got more troubles than Sacramento. I was on the way to the office one morning when things were particularly tough and there was a lot of criticism going on, and I tuned in a disc jockey, and I don't know who he was, but I learned to love him. He interrupted the music to say that every man should take unto himself a wife, because eventually something is bound to happen you can't blame on the governor. But in keeping with the purpose that brings us together, I have to tell you that I am struck that there is a parallel between football and my present job. Being governor and playing down in the center of the line is a little bit like a 3-pound chicken trying to lay a 4-pound egg. No matter how it turns out, it's going to hurt. But seriously, I am deeply honored to be here and to share the dais with men who have achieved so much and contributed so much to football. To be here, however, in this capacity as the recipient of this award is overwhelming. and I have no words to express my pride and my appreciation. The only possible qualification I have, not to justify my receiving this award, but at least to try and rationalize it in my own mind, is that I have been involved in a love affair with football that began as far back as my memory goes. We lived a small town in Illinois on a low bluff overlooking the high school football team. Every autumn afternoon, as far back as I can remember, I spent watching every minute of football practice, and eventually going to high school there meant going out for football. 4 years and two varsity letters later, I went to college for the same reason. Now, unless you're from Illinois, you have to ask, well, where's Eureka College? And if I told you, you wouldn't know a hell of a lot more than you know right now. Maybe there are some old-timers, particularly connected with the pro game, who will remember that there was a conference of prairie colleges known as the Little 19. This was in a day before the athletic scholarship had sort of sorted out the smaller schools. The game was Simon Pure then. A football player just had to work at back-breaking jobs like winding the gym clock. The Little 19 Conference was rather distinctive. It was somewhat innovative in that it was the only conference in the United States in which you could be employed as an assistant coach, physical ed instructor, and play summer baseball for money without tarnishing your amateur standing. In my senior year, our starting lineup had seven athletic instructors, and I was the swimming coach. But seriously, I'm indebted to football for so many things. Football provided an education. As a matter of fact, it provided my career. In 1932, when you graduated, you didn't start out to have a career. You just hoped that some way you could find a job, any kind of job. And I received $5 in bus fare to broadcast the Iowa-Minnesota game for a local radio station. And that turned into a sports announcing career. And even later in Hollywood, when I found myself bogged down making some pictures that the studio didn't want them necessarily good, it just wanted them on Thursday, the Gipper won one for me and made everything that's happened since possible. But I'm indebted for much more than just those boosts along the career path. I know that it's become cliche to talk about the lessons of living that are learned in the gridiron, and many men eloquently here tonight have remarked about those things. But cliches are born of unchanging truth. Something becomes a cliche because it has happened and happens so consistently. In Hollywood, we like to sit around on the set and joke about cliche lines. One of them in the adventure film is, always there is that line, we're safe till the drums stop. Well, that cliche. That cliche is based on truth, because in the real life situation of that kind, it means when they stop beating those drums, they're on their way to beat your heads out with a club. Teddy Roosevelt once spoke of those who have known the blood and sweat of the arena, men who've known what it means to win and what it means to lose. Well, in Eureka, we learned a great deal about losing. The funny thing is, I don't mind. I remember once when a few of us went to our coach. We wanted to talk to him about scheduling. We were a little tired of losing as often as we did. And then he told us why we had the kind of schedule we did. We were a tiny, unknown school. He said, yes, I can give you a schedule. I can give you a schedule in which you can probably win every game. But he said, would you rather do that? Or would you rather play as you're playing now, against schools that, at a minimum, are 10 times your size? Against schools that it's an achievement to even be on their schedule and be out in the field? And if you play on even terms, and so you lose by a touchdown, or two touchdowns, or a point. Doesn't that and won't that mean more to you when this is all over than having those easy wins on a schedule that's someplace down in our size? And now today, I know what he was talking about. And when we did win, Oh, my, how sweet it was. But, you know, I think all of us here love sports and we have an affinity for all of the games. But somehow, there is a mystic something about football. Your presence here acknowledges that. Anyone who has played in more than the one sport, and most athletes do, knows there's something unique, something that captures the spectator and the player, captures him emotionally about football, that he can feel about football more seriously, that he can feel so seriously that sometimes there are those who tend to sneer a little and want to remind us that it's only a game. The other day, a group of psychiatrists said that we should abandon this game. They said it was a primitive appeal to our inner aggressions. Well, I dare them to prove that football players have a built-in tendency to spend an evening in the park massaging their fellow citizens' head with an iron pipe. Sometimes I think a psychiatrist... Sometimes I think a psychiatrist is a fellow who tells you you're crazy and then gets you to give him $50 an hour to prove it. But let me, if I could be so presumptuous, try for a moment to put my finger on that indefinable quality that marks football. We live in an over-civilized world that no longer calls upon man to survive by dint of physical prowess. And football, somehow, is the last thing we have, the last place where men can engage in non-fatal combat and do so by literally flinging themselves and flinging their body against another human being, against an opponent. Ask a lineman who's just smashed through and upended a ball carrier in a head-on tackle if he envies the fella that happens to run across the goal line for the touchdown. I think he'll tell you right at that moment he wouldn't trade places with anyone. There's no feeling exactly like it. There's a hot, clean hatred for an opponent during a game. You don't hate him in any kind of a mean, human way that is demeaning to you. But you hate him not because you even see a human face opposite you as you line up waiting for the ball to be snapped. He's a symbol of an enmity. He's an enemy by virtue of the color of his jersey. And the hatred you feel is almost the same righteous hatred that you have for evil. And in that moment, he to you is the symbol of evil. And when the ball is snapped, however, you express that hatred within a very definite framework of rules, and you apply tactics that have been taught you to make a play that, and to carry out assignments that will make a play work and gain success for your team. And then when the final gun sounds, every man who's ever played knows how suddenly that hatred is replaced with a genuine affection and respect, the kind of feeling that two men can have who have intimately shared that kind of experience for the last few hours of that afternoon or evening. Now, there are, of course, individuals who cheat. They're to be found any place, and I suppose in football, too. And yet I believe that football is actually miraculously clean when you consider the opportunity for wrongdoing. On every play, at least 15 or 16 out of 22 men have an opportunity to do serious physical injury to another human being, and for the most part, with no possibility of being detected. It's a violent game. Men are injured. But unlike the ancient gladiator sports, the injury is incidental. It is not the object of the game. I find for all of these reasons, maybe it imperfectly explains some of what I've tried to express about this game, but football is peculiar to America. And that isn't strange. It's typical of the American personality. And I, for one, think that something very important in America would be lost if those psychiatrists had their way and we ever lost our emotional attachment to this game. I don't happen to think there's anything wrong with young men at that stage of their life feeling so deeply about an abstraction such as team spirit or a school or just our side that would make a young man, even as he faced death, speak and make the request that George Gipp made on his deathbed. Nor do I find anything strange that 8 years later, another group of young men who had never known him personally would be so deeply moved at hearing his request that they would go out and rise above themselves in order to fulfill that request. What does it matter if it's only a game? If it has the power to make boys become men capable of self-sacrifice and unselfish, noble deeds? I don't know whether football made this contribution to America or America made it to football. But I know that football players have the ability to understand a young man on a much larger playing field in Vietnam a couple of years ago, a young Negro soldier who threw himself on a grenade to save his platoon mates. And I doubt if he paused to count how many of them were white or black or brown, and it so happens there was a pretty good distribution of each. But his dying words were, "You have to care." Today, an increasing number of voices are being raised in our land. They're urging an end to competitive sports. It's a murmur in some places, but watch out for it. Indeed, you will find that they find competition in our whole social structure undesirable. Their song is that every, by man's very nature, can be changed by controlling his environment. And they have some kind of a dream of a non-competitive, placid world. But if they have their way, and I sometimes think that what they really mean is, in the end of competition, a leveling down to a mediocrity for all of us, or there won't be any need for competition. Can they promise us, if they have their way, that there will never again be a time when we need heroes, when we need men who have known the blood and sweat of the arena, what it is to overcome weariness and pain and find another untapped source of strength within yourself when it seems that all strength is gone? Oh, these are the men that tell us we don't need grades anymore, just pass or fail. I don't know about you, but if I ever lie down on an operating table and they put the thing over my face to put me to sleep, I would like to know more about the man with the knife in his hand that it just happened to get by. This fine young quarterback, and I was watching you on the tube last week and coming out of my chair several times. You spoke of athletes being known as jocks. A few years ago, there were people that sneeringly called athletes gorillas. There is a tendency on the part of a number of people to try and pretend that the athlete is somehow something apart from the rest of us. But you only had to look at that list of men, or that lineup of men back there who stood up, at the men who are sitting here beside you tonight, to understand that you can look at the record of the men who've been a part of this game back through the years, and I'll match it against any other group they want to put together. I remember one night in an old classroom building on our Eureka campus, we were having whatever they call it now, I don't know, skull session, a chalk talk, going over plays and so forth under those cold, bare bulbs. And somehow, I don't know how, the subject of prayer came up. I think the coach must have introduced it, but I don't know just how he did it. Now, I was one of the younger fellas. I was one of the few that had come direct from high school. I never went into a game that I didn't pray to myself, but I would have cut my hand off before I would have admitted it to that bunch of roughnecks that I was associating with on the team, because I thought I must be the only person did anything like that. And I would never have opened my mouth about it. But as the conversation went on, and man after man began speaking up, it developed that every man in the room prayed silently into himself before he went into a game. Now, I'd kind of developed a prayer of my own, and what I thought it was fair to ask for. Obviously, you couldn't ask the Lord to be on your side and win, as the fellow on the other side had as much claim on him as I did. But I was amazed to find out, when finally it all came out from every man, that every man in that room had almost the same identical prayer: not to win, But let me do my best. Let there be no injuries. Not just me. Let there be no injuries. Let everyone play his best. So I wonder if it's too much to suggest that maybe they learned the tone of that prayer from the very principles of the game they were playing. I remember a couple of seasons back when the Los Angeles Rams had won 11 straight and they were going to play the Vikings, and it didn't matter because both of them had won their titles, respective titles, and so this was just a game for the crowd. And I took my 11-year-old son, who is a worshiper of football and a particular fan of the Los Angeles Rams. And we sat there in the stadium that day, and the Rams had a bad day, and the Vikings poured it on. And all around us, I heard cynical talk about, well, they're fellas who play for money. They're not trying very hard because the game doesn't mean anything. And I even heard talk about they probably shave the points a little bit for the gamblers. And all I could do was kind of shoulder over against my 11-year-old, and I knew he was hearing it. And he also takes defeat very, very personally. The eyes were looking a little glassy and as if they might break over in a minute. I'd kept one secret from him. I had an invitation to bring him down to the locker room after the game, but we had to catch a plane, and I didn't want to tell him about it in advance and then maybe find that time was such that we couldn't do it. But there was time. So to ease his disappointment at the defeat, I told him. Well, that brightened the day, and down we went to the locker room. And in they came. Well, anyone who thought they weren't trying, they'd been through a meat grinder. They were bleeding, literally. They were also very angry about not playing up to their standard. And I stood there beside him. They sat down in this kind of a classroom type of place they have. And they, for about 7 minutes, they poured it on themselves about how badly they'd done. And at about that moment, Coach Allen said to him, okay, that's enough. Let's give thanks. And I stood there and saw my 11-year-old bow his head as those big, hulking heroes of his dropped to their knees and repeated the Lord's Prayer. No lesson that I could ever teach him, nothing could I ever say, would mean as much. And I went out of there, I don't care. They won the game as far as I was concerned. I don't know if we'll ever be able to identify and prove what each man learns from football so that we can list it and hang it on a wall like a diploma or like a license for the practice of a profession. I do know that down through the years, I've somehow placed my faith in men of the sports world, and seldom has that faith ever been betrayed. A few years ago, Bud Wilkinson was having those great teams. He knows what I'm going to tell now. He had those national championship teams. They were playing TCU in their final game. And TCU'd had a lackluster season. It had been pretty dull for them. But now, as a team will, they rose to the heights. And in the closing minutes of the game in the fourth quarter, the score was Oklahoma leading 20-14. And then a TCU pass, and a man dived into the end zone and caught what was apparently the tying touchdown, but with the great probability of it being a one-point victory over the national champions. There was bedlam in the stadium. And then that young man who'd caught the pass got up and walked over to the referee, handed him the ball, and said, "No, sir, it touched the ground before I caught it." Now, I don't know where that end, he was the team captain, John Crouch, is. I've been told that he's coaching. I never met him, but I wish my son could grow up and play under him someday. I think that I'm a better man just knowing about that story. I think all who hear it are. Perhaps those who think that winning is all important would say he should have kept his mouth shut. He hadn't been caught, he could get away with it. But I wonder if the same person would like to feel that that's the way a president of the United States should make his decisions, or a senator, or a congressman, or a justice of the Supreme Court. Or do we really want men who make decisions not out of expediency, whether it's in business or public affairs or personal affairs, but on a basis of what they honestly believe in their hearts is morally right? I hope my remarks have given you some idea of what this award means to me. You know, there were no Emmys when I was a sports announcer. There were Oscars when I was an actor, but I didn't get one. And I'm sure I'm never going to get an honorary degree from Berkeley. Yeah. as I said, that's unimportant, because football has given me an education, it gave me a career, and now it has given me an honor that I cherish more than I can say. It is sweet to be approved by your fellow man. It is doubly so when that approval comes from men you admire, respect, and hold in high esteem. All I can say is tonight, I thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Memorable, Governor. Now, gentlemen, the benediction, the Reverend E.P. Joyce of Notre Dame. Father?
Almighty God, in humility and gratitude, we bring this memorable evening to a close. We thank you for the opportunity that you've given to each of us to be here tonight, and to be inspired by the example and the words of these great men. We ask your continued blessing on the leaders of this organization who are doing so much for our nation and for the youth of our nation. This we ask in the name of our Lord. Amen.